Welcome everyone to concurrent session 2A, ICAP, 1 year on. My name is Dan Antioch and I'll be chairing this session. Our presenters today are Brylan Cummings and Rob Curtis. So Brylan is a partner at KPMG and has over 15 years of experience in life insurance. In her current role, Brylan advises life insurers and boards on a range of issues including capital management, financial and risk management, experience analyses, and ICAP implementation in both assistance and review roles. Rob Curtis is a director at KPMG and leads KPMG's ASPAC Insurance Risk and Regulatory Insurance Practice, as well as being KPMG's Global Regulatory Lead for Insurance. Rob was previously responsible for the Global Regulatory Centre of Excellence for Insurance across Europe, the Middle East and Africa, and has significant experience in regulation, having developed the UK ICAS regime and leading the FSA's Solvency II program. Prior to joining the UK FSA, Rob successfully led the risk and capital transformation projects at the largest UK life and non-life firms, respectively. Rob has also provided strategic and technical and management advice and assistance to the Association of British Insurers for their Solvency II programs, drafted the CRO Forum paper on recovery and resolution plans, and leads KPMG's global response for insurance and systemic risk issues. Please welcome Brylan and Rob.
Good afternoon, everyone. The impetus for this presentation was really that ICAP's been in place for about 16 months, and before ICAP was introduced, there was a huge amount of activity documenting everything, making sure that everyone had a tick against everything in the LPS capital management. And the focus was really all about compliance, making sure that on day one you had all those ticks. We did a lot of readiness reviews around that sort of framework as well. And since then, it's sort of been 16 months. And what I was interested in seeing was how companies have moved in that 16 months in terms of moving beyond the compliance into sort of the more the value add. In that time, I've also seen that the ICAP has moved out of sort of what I'd call project land into BAU, in that activities which companies are now doing, they're doing out of BAU resource, and if they want to do something, they typically have to stop doing something else. So you have kind of a priority conflict at the moment. So advances are sort of, I guess, hard won at this point. What I'm going to talk today is a little bit about who owns the ICAP, the sophistication of the ICAP, and contrast Australia and the UK there, and also talk about whether companies are actually finding that it's been a value add. We're relying heavily upon two surveys for our findings. First is an Australian survey. We surveyed 14 companies which had a mix of size, reinsurer and direct office. They were conducted by interview, and to all the insurance companies who participated, thank you very much. The UK ORSA survey was also 14 companies. It was also a mix of reinsurer and direct offices, and we also did those surveys by interview. The purpose of that survey in the UK was to assess the maturity of the ongoing ORSA and the wider risk management framework of Solvency II. It's obviously been in place for a bit longer there, so they were wanting to assess how mature it was in terms of sophistication. So the purpose of the two surveys were fairly consistent. The board owns the ICAP, but what we're interested in is who in the company is actually owning the ICAP in a BAU sense. And when I surveyed companies in 2012, most companies thought that the ICAP would have multiple owners, and they thought that the appointed actuary and the CFO would be most likely be the people who owned it. Now it's more common to have a single owner rather than multiple owners, and the most common owner is actually the chief risk officer. It's interesting that sort of areas such as legal and treasury, which were initially thought of as being potential owners, have sort of dropped off, and I think that's reflecting the fact that companies have started to move out of the compliance space and more into that value add space. Company size did not seem to be a factor in terms of whether you had multiple owners or single owners or who was actually owning the ICAP in the end. The next thing is who actually does all the work now that you've established who owns it. And if I was to look at a large bank, I might see a team which had people drawn from risk functions, finance functions, treasury functions, bringing all that skill and capability into a single team which could then manage the ICAP. Now, in the life insurance space at the moment, that doesn't really exist. We've had sort of one company say yes, they have it, and I could probably really say there's about three companies who would say yes. But really what they're saying is they have a single person whose job is ICAP, and they then rely upon a larger virtual team to actually fulfil that role. So we don't in any companies have a team which is multiple people. We do in a few companies have a single person whose role is ICAP. There's also five companies who don't have a virtual team, who have instead segmented responsibilities across areas and are relying upon the fact that they've done that segmentation of responsibility sufficiently well that you don't need to have a steering group or a working group draw those capabilities back together to get the insights. When I thought about ICAP being introduced, I think one of the big leaps for the actuarial profession, big leaps for the life insurance companies, was the need to sort of integrate that risk function and actuarial function. Previously, you sort of had actuaries doing capital management and you had the risk function doing risk management, and there wasn't a lot of coordination between those two. So what we asked is, in terms of the development of the risk management framework, training of the board and senior management in the ICAP, drafting the summary statement, drafting the ICAP report, developing scenarios and developing the capital management plan, how much interaction was there between the risk and actuarial functions? And it was really pleasing to see that for the majority of those, the risk and actuarial functions were working closely together, particularly in the scenario development area. It was often the case that one had developed and the other reviewed. In terms of the sophistication of the ICAP itself, it sort of goes from sort of black letter compliance at one end over to very sophisticated at the other end. And when you go between those two structures, what you see is you see companies moving from sort of siloed where risk assessment is done in silos, business planning is done in silos. There's lots of silos moving over to a structure where everything is much more integrated and interactive. You're moving sort of from compliance over to strategic and value add. And I kind of think that you move from focusing upon trying to minimise bad things happening, so you're trying to minimise the fact that somebody will go off and do something you don't want them to do, or minimise the risk that you might go insolvent. It's all about minimising problems over to maximising. So you move from that over to you want to maximise your value, you want to optimise your capital. So you're moving kind of from a negative focus to a positive focus in terms of what you perceive as the value that you're getting from your ICAP. I asked companies if they had to make a statement, I think my ICAP is adequate and effective, did they think that they could currently make it? Or would they be tempted to say, I think my ICAP is adequate and effective, disclaimer along the lines of, given that it's only been in place for 18 months? And five companies thought that they could make that statement. Interestingly enough, out of those five companies who thought they could make the statement, two of them, we went through the rest of the survey, then said that they were looking to make significant changes to their ICAP in terms of sophistication. So it was interesting that they felt they could make the statement, but they still felt they needed to sort of develop further sophistication. In terms of the nine companies who didn't feel they could make the statement, I asked them what they knew about their target state, what they knew about what their company would look like in order to be able to make that statement. And only three companies actually knew what it would look like and had documented that. Five companies had sort of discussions and it was in people's heads, but it wasn't necessarily concrete, and one company hadn't even had the discussion. For the rest of these slides, I'm going to be talking about a target state, and that target state will be reflecting the person who I had the discussion with, bearing in mind that in some companies where they haven't actually documented the target state, if I'd spoken to somebody else, I might have got quite a different response. In terms of these surveys, we compared an Australian survey and a UK survey, and unfortunately they weren't done along quite the same lines, but they're They do have a lot of areas of comparison. In Australia, we surveyed on six different components, being governance, risk assessment, capital plan and management, stress and scenario testing, capital recovery and restoration, and embedding. And in the UK, they sort of split that governance out into four components, which were roles and responsibilities, the ICAAP process itself, or the ORSA process itself, documentation, and how aligned it was to business planning. The risk assessment was split out into four areas, which were the risk management system, the risk appetite, material and emerging risks. Capital plan and management was split out into the solvency capital requirement and capital projections. Stress and scenario testing was broadly equivalent. They didn't consider capital recovery and restoration, and embedding was broadly similar. When we look through these slides, I've sort of got a spectrum of ICAAP sophistication, which goes from black letter compliance through to what I call as compliance-led, but it's really, you're moving beyond compliance, but it's still sort of focused upon minimising those issues, not focused on the positive side yet. Moving more into the value add, having distinct value add, and sort of leading edge sophistication. The UK survey looked at it slightly differently. They looked at it in terms of lagging, development, good, and leading, but it's broadly the same thing. I think it's very important when you can think about sophistication to realise that more sophisticated is not necessarily better. The more sophisticated you are, the more complex your tools are, the more functionality you need in your tools. And the value that you get from those tools and that functionality and that understanding may not actually be worthwhile in terms of the cost for your organisation. And that's really where we talk about, you know, is your ICAAP adequate and effective for your size and nature of organisation, because depending upon how complex your organisation, in theory, depends upon how sophisticated your organisation is. And I'll talk about at the end whether, when we looked at organisations by their size, complexity, etc., whether we actually saw a difference in terms of the sophistication of the ICAAP. Rob.
Okay, so now we're going to do a little bit of a double act. So good afternoon, everyone, and I am Rob Curtis. So what we're going to try and do now is just run through a little bit of what we saw in the UK. As Dan said, I was a large architect of Solvency II. Please don't hold that against me. The news is we're almost there in Europe, so that's at least something, after about 10-odd years. So really, what I wanted to say to you today was this is a journey. You know, I know a lot of people are introducing and developing their ICAAPs now. It does take a long time. If you know, the past is any guide to the future, you can well rest assured from the UK experience, it has taken us quite a long time to reach this point. And even that we're, you know, at this point, after a good 5 years, I would say, of really serious Solvency II analysis, and there's been, beyond that, the ICAS work, which was introduced, you know, for probably another 5 years beyond that. There is still a lot to do. And if you look at this one here, roles and responsibilities, we just, in our survey, we cut them up and sliced them slightly differently. But effectively, under roles and responsibilities, we said, actually, you know, what is the involvement of the boards, for example? And it's not really clear the sort of challenge process that the boards are really giving back on some of these ORSAs. So in the UK, it is the own risk and solvency assessment. Here, it's the ICAAP, in using the banking terminology, of course. And so it was really very much around who is owning this at the organisation, where is the board's influence on some of these you know, aspects of analysis. And that was something which was still a little bit lacking, if you like, in terms of the clarity around what is the board's engagement, how much are they involved, what are they really doing in terms of, you know, signing off on some of these reports. The other one, because we've got quite a bit of material, so I'll just quickly go through some of these. In terms of the process. It was very much still on an annual basis, so that is still something that in the UK there hasn't been probably, you would say, enough consideration given to how you might do this on an ad hoc basis. So in the UK, particularly with the PRA now, the Prudential Regulatory Authority, taking over from the FSA, the view is very much the ORSA should be dynamic. It should actually be able to be resubmitted if there is a significant change in the business. And that hadn't been really given enough thought or consideration other than this is something we do as an annual basis. And as a result, in the UK, it becomes a little bit of a compliance exercise, and people start to think, oh no, here we go back through this process again, we'll dust it off what we did last year and, you know, what's changed. So that is there's sort of a prevailing sense of a little bit that in the market at the moment. In terms of documentation, this is always a bugbear of your supervisor. It's always a hot issue for the UK supervisors. It was basically deemed that there was not enough documentation of the process, if you like, for how insurers got to the risk analysis that they did. And when they were first submitted off under ICAS to the FSA, that was pretty much the response that came back, which was, we can't make head or tail of what you've really done. All you've presented is just a mere almost checklist of what you've gone through. And actually, if we're supervising you, we can't really understand what the board has done, what you've done in terms of feedback loops, how it's changed at the end of the sort of business cycle, you know, what you've done going forward in terms of new emerging risks, all that sort of stuff. The documentation was really largely lacking. So there has been quite a bit of work of late trying to beef that up, and of course everyone is now trying to get a better ORSA in play, but very much around the sort of structure and the gaps that I've mentioned were not fully quite there. Then when you look at alignment to business planning processes and what that looked like, still very much in the early to mid stages of the introduction in the UK, but also in more particularly across Europe with Solvency II, there is a difficulty in aligning the strategy with the risk appetite and the business planning processes. And I would expect that that would be something similar to probably what you're experiencing here as well, mainly because it's a new process. It is quite a new piece of risk analysis that needs to go through in terms of the all of the different stakeholders, all of the different inputs that need to occur and go back through, as I mentioned, those loops. That actually takes quite a bit of time to get right, if you like. And the UK experience has certainly been going back through the whole business planning process is not necessarily a straightforward aspect.
So in terms of Australia, we sort of encapsulated all of those various areas under governance. And you can see that at the moment in the life insurance industry, we range from sort of black letter law compliant at the minimum end all the way up to something quite sophisticated at the maximum end. But on average, companies are probably more in the, compliance-led area at the moment. Companies do, however, have quite a lot of ambition. Everyone's looking to sort of move beyond that black letter law compliance, and companies are on average looking to move quite away into the sophisticated area. So not even kind of borderline value add or not, moving definitely into the value add area, with some companies wanting to be leading edge in this area. Just hand over to...
Okay, so... So what we're trying to do is just sort of say, what's the UK experience been, and then how does that marry against what we're seeing in Australia at the moment? So in terms of risk management systems, limited content really on the key decisions and changes taken around the risk management system. There was not really a lot of detail provided by most of the firms in this area. And so you'll see for most of them there's a common theme in terms of we put this as developing. You couldn't really describe it as good practice necessarily. It certainly wasn't lagging, though. But I think if you then extrapolated this across and got the European firm's perspective, you'd probably see quite a little bit of a difference there between the UK and the rest of Europe. But particularly around, the key decisions that are being made, how does that feed back into the overall risk management system? That is probably an area that still is in need of development. In terms of risk appetite, and this is always the subject matter which gets your supervisor excited, it certainly has been in the UK, this is something which I think the UK experience has been one which has largely been at the beginning. It was poorly articulated in terms of particularly the quantitative and qualitative aspects, trying to actually, really hone those down in terms of what does that mean in terms of the firm's risk appetite, was certainly very challenging. And linking that risk appetite to the actual decision-making process, not very clear in terms of the stated, say, tolerance limits, and how that actually brought back down into what happens when you might, for example, have a breach. What might you do around some of those considerations? Not very well thought through yet. But as I say, that is an area which is faster becoming addressed, because effectively now Solvency II is back on the agenda. I think there was a period maybe about 18 months ago, 12 months ago, even, when it sort of fell off a little bit because of it looked like Solvency II might never reach the end of light. And so firms sort of dropped quite a bit of work around risk appetite in particular, because it is one of the more difficult areas to get right, and flow back through the business planning process. With the announcement that it's back on and 2016 is the date, a lot of that work has come back to the fore. In terms of material risk assessment, I think there's a number of issues with group-specific risks, which the UK firms have found a little bit difficult, particularly around identifying reputational and strategic risk-type issues. So a lot of those sort of, if you like, softer, risk issues have been slightly difficult for UK firms to really bring in. Perhaps little consideration as well around the risk consolidated and aggregated number positions, particularly at group level. So this is, again, quite difficult. It's a new, route for a lot of the UK groups as well, around producing the group also. So this is not necessarily an easy exercise. And no formal assessment of the three lines of defence. I think that's the UK supervisors. I believe APRA is very similar in terms of its three lines of defence approach. And there's no real hasn't been anyone really stepping back at the group level and saying who's actually really assessing each of those three lines properly and undertaking that sort of risk assessment and view. Now, if we look at emerging risk assessment, that leads quite nicely on to what that looks like. And I think it's another developing area, particularly in the UK, where they need to do more around emerging risk assessment and trying to achieve the balance, actually, between the sort of financial and non-financial emerging risks. And more analysis around that is probably required. And then what process firms have done for actually reviewing the emerging risks that are on the horizon. So a lot of this too came out of the financial crisis. I think a lot of people were caught a little bit unaware really of the magnitude of some of those extreme events, and so these sorts of emerging risks really were now brought very much to the fore in terms of a regulatory perspective, and not enough of that analysis has yet managed to take its way back through in terms of the ALSA. I'll hand back over to Brian.
I think the comments that Rob made broadly reflect what I experienced when I talked to companies in Australia. Some of the key things that companies were having difficulty was translating that broad overarching risk appetite statement down into what it actually means in terms of tolerance limits for claims, lapses, and things that you could actually monitor on a day-to-day basis. Companies having difficulty making that translation. The other area where companies have struggled a little bit, I think, is getting that consistency between their operational risks and their financial risks, so that if you put your hand on your heart, could you say that a risk which you've categorised as, say, medium in both your financial and your operational risk would actually lead to sort of the same magnitude of loss? That sort of area. In terms of where companies currently are, they range from sort of the black letter law compliance through to kind of just on the cusp of value add at the moment, with most companies being towards the middle. In terms of the target state, everybody's aiming to be in the value add area here, and I think this is because clearly understanding your risks is something that we all appreciate and understand will add value to our business. And most companies are not aiming to be very far in terms of sophistication. They're just aiming to be just over the line into the value add area. But there are some companies that are looking to get really quite sophisticated here.
Okay, so that takes us on to ECR and looking at the economic capital requirements there and the solvency capital requirement, the SCR. And I think I think it's fair to say in the UK there's still more work that needs to occur around the analysis of both of those measures. This is particularly an area for a lot of firms globally anyway, as they supervisors go into more of an economic valuation route. It's actually then what is the surplus, if you like, between the two, how much volatility is there, and also I think around pillar two there's an area of further work in terms of looking at the analysis and how does that feed back through to some of those economic capital and SCR type decisions. Then in terms of projection of capital, I think over here what we're seeing is a need in the UK for more capital projections over the planning cycle. I think that is probably an area of development which is still ongoing. And what you'll see, the lines above really are sort of where the different firms that we interviewed have really come out. So you can sort of see no one's really in that sort of right-hand side yet. And as I say, it's mainly because, this is a new area. The volatility around some of the projected capital numbers is also an area where you'd say there's probably further analysis that could benefit the ORSA. And potential change in the quality of own funds and what that might mean to the balance sheet and to the overall capital positions is probably another area where there's still some ongoing work that is required.
In terms of Australia, I think we're probably a bit further along in terms of sophistication of capital plan and management than the UK. A lot of the conversation that I had revolved around how exactly do I take my capital and take it down to product level or distribution channel effectively. And I think there's now also a realisation that you can see companies are looking to move from where they are, which is just on the cusp of value add on average, over to being quite sophisticated. And they're now starting to think about what that might look like and realise that although they've invested a great deal in terms of capital models over the past few years, the capital model that's going to deliver them the functionality in the right-hand side there isn't necessarily the model they have today and doesn't necessarily look anything like the model they have today. And how you go about saying, well, although we've invested all this money, we actually need to invest a lot more money in order to deliver that functionality and that results.
One of the other areas we also looked at was around stress testing and reverse stress testing, and I think it's fair to say that reverse stress testing generally is an area where it's still largely in development for a lot of the UK firms, and there hasn't been a lot of further work in that regard, but that is now picking up quite substantially, mainly because the UK PRA has now, as one of their fundamental business requirements, put resolution analysis in as a key requirement. So effectively, every insurer has to be able to demonstrate how they would resolve themselves in the event of another crisis. And so that is actually one of the core business requirements that are in the UK now. So that's put added pressure, if you like, and added momentum back to being able to say, can we understand, you know, what is the ultimate point of insolvency for the firm, not just regulatory, but commercial, and what does that mean working backwards? What are our trigger points? What are our management actions? How would we resolve some of those and act in advance? So there's a limitation to some of the sensitivities that have been tested to date, but you would expect in the next year or two that that will certainly come forth.
In Australia, this is once again an area where companies are sort of looking to significantly improve their functionality. In terms of what companies are currently doing, they're sort of split. The companies are either doing one or two scenarios, but they're doing them really comprehensively, or they're doing sort of five or more, but they're not doing them in any of the way, anything like the same level of detail or the same level of interaction with the company, the board, senior management. Where companies are looking at is they're looking not necessarily to have a better model to do their scenario testing, but they're looking to have more interaction with the business so they get more value out of having done the work. They're also looking to have them more integrated with business planning, and that's where you can see companies are really looking to get into that value add area so that when they look at what their business plan is, they have an understanding of, is this actually going to be the best business plan in a variety of circumstances? I'm next again. Capital recovery and restoration. This is an interesting area. APRA's spoken about it quite a lot recently, and they've spoken about moving it up the priority list. And when I spoke to companies, companies don't seem to be moving it up the priority list. A lot of companies in Australia have a parent of some sort, and so their capital recovery or restoration plan consists of asking their parent for some more money, please. It's interesting that in some companies, there was really no appetite at all to move beyond that point because management doesn't have an appetite because their parent has no appetite for them to develop anything further. A few companies had independent directors who were really getting quite, concerned about this and were forcing the business to then say, no, we actually want you to do some more in this area, and that's where that sort of that push was coming from. There are some companies who are looking to become very sophisticated, and that's probably not a surprise considering that although, you know, the majority of the industry does have parents, there are a few very large companies that don't and are looking to make sure that they are properly resourced in terms of knowing what they do for capital raising.
Okay, and the last but not least area that we looked at in the UK was very much around this use and decision making. It's always the use test. This is something which the supervisors are always hot to trot on. And effectively, I think one of the biggest issues actually in the UK has been the inability of the UK firms to really articulate the results of the ORSA process through each of the years. So it's a bit like, well, this is what we did this year. What have we learnt? What have we actually done post that period in the next 12 months? And this is particularly from the ICAS experience. So in the UK, you know, we have had now a number of years where firms have been able to have that, you know, journey, if you like. This is new still in Europe because I haven't yet submitted the ORSAs. But in the UK, you've had the ICAS leading into effectively the ORSAs now. A number of iterations going through to the regulator. And there has been I think the feedback from firms and also the PRA now is very much there hasn't been the insight into what's really been learned as a result of that, you know, last 12-month period. What have you done since in terms of making better business decisions? What are you doing actually with the information and the material? Where are the feedback loops? And this is where the supervisors, and I imagine APRA will do something very similar, is saying we really want to see how you're actually driving the business as a result of this process, and how that links in with the whole strategic and business planning process overall, rather than it being merely a compliance exercise. And that's one of the key sort of learning points effectively out of the UK so far.
in Australia, I think the majority of companies are probably wanting to target some level of sophistication. You can see that it's not surprising. Embedding was left to sort of be done after you've done everything else, I think, and so broadly it's probably one of the more unsophisticated ends. It's interesting to have a look at where companies are targeting and that companies are sort of targeting the full spectrum. When I talked to companies about embedding, it was really interesting because there are companies who have a parent and that parent is giving the company metrics which don't necessarily align with ICAP, so they might care about economic value, which isn't aligned at the moment with regulatory capital. They might give their company just revenue objectives. And so when you have those objectives coming down from your parent, to say that you're going to embed ICAP in your organisation is very difficult because your objectives are always going to be led by what you're getting rewarded on, which isn't aligned necessarily with ICAP. In terms of that target state, it did seem a very broad target state to me. So I had a look at where companies had actually sort of put themselves. And I removed two companies, and suddenly you can see that everyone is actually quite aligned in terms of where they're looking at in that sort of spectrum there. So there's obviously a couple of extreme companies looking to do not very much or looking to do a huge amount, but broadly companies are looking to sort of be in that cusp of the value add range. So we've got this statement, appropriate to life company size, business mix and complexity of its operations. And we're talking about the company's target state. So considering we just had a look at all those ranges, which were all huge in terms of where companies wanted to be on the target state, if I had a look at the average of large companies and small companies, or large and non-large companies, you can see they're actually extraordinarily close, indicating that where companies are targeting is completely unrelated to their size and is driven by other metrics. The next I had a look at whether a company was part of a conglomerate or not. And you can see that here we're getting a bit more of a spectrum. So if you're a conglomerate, you're more likely to be more sophisticated than if you're not part of a conglomerate. And the last I looked at is whether you were part of a bank or a reinsurance group or whether you weren't. And this is where I was talking about the fact that if you're part of that group and the message coming down from you from that group is not aligned to your ICAP, you're going to be targeting something very less sophisticated than if you're not part of that group. I asked companies about their challenges in reaching their target state, given that what we saw is that everyone set quite an ambitious target state, and everyone set that target state saying, we'd like to be there generally within 1 to 2 years. And the biggest problem companies identified was resourcing. And it was they talked about prioritisation in that there are multiple objectives within the companies at the moment. And it's a question of not that they don't have the right resources, it's a question of the resources aren't necessarily doing this work, they're doing other things to add value to the company. The next thing the companies talked about was simply time. And this was really in relation to embedding as well as some other issues, which was basically they've started an education program or they've started discussions to reach consensus on something as to how we should go forward. And it will take time for that education to occur or time for those discussions to occur before you can go forth and do the next development. And I think that's sort of reflected in where companies' focus is on the next year. So I sort of talk about companies refreshing or extending. And refreshing is where you're really looking at what am I currently doing now and can I just do that a little bit better or have a bit more solidity behind it versus extending, whereas I'm actually making a leap in terms of capability. And generally companies were sort of split between whether they want to refresh or whether they want to extend. And often they were looking at improving their scenario analysis or embedding the ICAP as being their top two priorities. The final question, and I think to me one of the more interesting ones, is the industry is spending a great deal of money on ICAP, nowhere near as much as ORSA, but a great deal of money. And at the end of the day, has this just been a really expensive board training exercise, or has the industry and management actually got value from it? And when I asked companies, only four companies felt that they had really added, that it had really added significant value. Two of them said it had added a little value, and they could see that it had added value, but probably management wouldn't perceive that it had added value. And five companies felt that it hadn't added value, but two of them said that they expected it to in future when they moved into sort of the value add area. We sort of, I guess, had to think a bit more of a think about, well, what does adding value mean? And so ICAP is meant to sort of help us navigate our way through crises better. And so we said, have you had an event in the last 12 months where you've had a significant reduction in your excess assets? And if so, did having the ICAP prove a benefit to your organisation? Did you identify any weaknesses in your ICAP, or was it of no value at all? Three lucky companies said they hadn't experienced a crisis, and out of the remainder, they were sort of equally split between finding benefits, finding weaknesses in their ICAP which they wanted to improve, and finding no value at all. The companies found no value at all said that they previously had in place a very strong capital management plan, and what they'd done in terms of the ICAP really didn't add anything to that capital management plan in terms of navigating their way through the crisis. The companies who were doing benefits and weaknesses were broadly talking about whether, when the event happened, they had sufficient clarity over what they were meant to do, who was meant to do it, and when it would occur, and what the options were available to management. And often the weaknesses were around, we wanted to have a greater clarity around what management could do at a certain point in time.
Okay, so just to conclude, if you like, a few concluding remarks on just where is the UK with our survey that we did. What's our sort of takeouts, if you like, from all of that? Because at first glance it can look a little bit, maybe thought they might have been a bit better than what they were. But I think actually you can see here, you know, 47% are saying actually it is adding real value to the overall business process, and we do use it a lot. 34% saying, well, it can occasionally help us improve, and then it goes down from there. And you've still got 4% who are saying, actually, it's not much use at all. So you've still got a reasonably large degree of difference, if you like, in terms of the value out of the ORSA process in the UK / now Solvency II, which you might say is probably surprising after, you know, a good 5-10 year period that the UK has had of doing this, but it quite largely reflects a view that you know, it has been initially very much a compliance exercise, and that sort of has tended to colour people's perceptions of how much use they really get out of the business for business purposes. And this set of bubbles, if you like, you can see there, you know, people are saying, yes, we use it constantly, we use past results, we look at what we've done to try and, you know, look at moving forward in a better way. We use stress and scenario testing, we use those elements, but only 17-odd%, so it's not a huge one. But there's a surprising still 28% who are saying, well, actually, we don't really have any mechanisms in which to measure the return on equity investment around their whole risk management process, around the whole ORSA work, if you like. And that's probably, I think, yeah, you know, just sort of the concluding view on, you know, it is hard to you know, to measure, and the value is often not quantified, but this is really the emerging area in the UK. People are now starting to move into how do we actually get value out of the risk management system, how do we actually put in a framework to do that, rather than it being a sort of a compliance perspective.
I think to quickly conclude on the Australian survey and leave it just a few minutes for questions, to me, out of all of it, was the fact that we have very ambitious plans in terms of what we want to do as an industry, but we don't necessarily have a plan as to what it looks like. We don't have a firm idea as to how much resource we're going to need. And management at the moment isn't seeing very much value in what we've done already in terms of, because they're seeing it as a compliance exercise. So how confident are we as an industry that we're going to get the funding in order to get all that resourcing need and achieve the target ICAP that we want to have? Thank you.
So I think we've got some time for some Q&A. Can I just remind everyone that the session is actually being recorded, so if we can have questions addressed to the microphone, and remember to introduce yourself before asking questions. Thanks. All right, I might get the ball rolling. What have been some of the sort of key learnings from the UK experience that the Australian insurers might benefit from? And what have been the most challenging sort of aspects of the ORSA implementation for UK firms, and why?
Yeah.
I'll take that one. I think one of the key learning outcomes has basically been, you know, if you look at what the UK has spent over the last, five odd years, and you also look at what the Europeans are now spending on the whole sort of Solvency II programs, you know, our best estimates is it's around about £3 billion, which is an enormous amount of money, and it's pounds, not dollars. So it's, you have to look at it, and firms are getting to the point, and they are coming to us as our clients as well, and saying, actually, we need your help, because we've just spent years putting forth a Solvency II program, but actually what we've realised is that this is largely very much one that's driven by compliance for PRA purposes rather than us using it for everyday business making decisions. And that is really, I think, the key takeout from where the Australian firms can learn from that. We did, as you would expect, as good consultants would, basically say to our clients, you really need to get value out of this spend. And to do that, you probably need to, spend this much. And the clients, bless, wanted to sort of bring that back and spend that much. And it was always because, look, we don't have the financial resources now to, spend that. We'd like to one day, but we can't. This is what can we get away with, effectively, was always the, if I had a dollar for every time I heard that, I'd be quite wealthy. So you ended up basically creating, if you like, a minimal framework which would actually allow them to, satisfy certain regulatory expectations, but actually left them still somewhat short for what they really wanted to use it going forward for capital and liquidity purposes, for example. And that is, I think, now the gap which is starting to open up, because people have realised they spent a lot of money, a lot of time on something which doesn't really get them any further ahead than where they really want to be. And that would be the key sort of takeout, I think, for the Aussie firms.
Martin Mulcahy, I'm going to take up Rob's subtle invitation to give a board perspective on this. One observation, one request, and one question. Observation, from a board perspective, we're certainly, in my experience, keen to get some value out of it. But it's still surprising in 2014 when board papers come to us with, say, a product proposal, that it still looks the same as a product proposal from last year, that we're not seeing from management or the actuarial team, explicit references to risk appetite, explicit references to risk capital, explicit references to the ICAP projections from the previous year. So my request for people here who I might be drafting, preparing or presenting board papers, can you please make sure that you're addressing these issues explicitly? And remember, your directors are simple people like me, hundreds of pages, so make it easy for us to find the references to risk appetite, risk capital, ICAP. The question then for both Rob and Briarlin, my experience would be that the board would initially saw it as a compliance exercise. The main, most of the questions in implementation were, does this meet APRA requirements, your experience, etc. But now we are trying to get some value. So what, from your perspective, might be good practice for a board in terms of its role in ICAP?
Based upon the companies I spoke to, it's really about emphasising that it's important and they want the money to be spent there. There's obviously limited resources. So it's a question of, if the board really cares about something, then it tends to happen and move up the priority list, versus if they don't make their wishes clear in that regard, it doesn't tend to happen. And I think it's a bit of what Rob was saying as well. It's very much a case of what's the minimum I can do to sort of achieve that functionality without spending something to actually have it being really solidly there.
Yeah, and I would just add to that. I mean, if you look at some of the... Well, if you look at nearly every, actually, UK ALSA report, you will find almost a complete absence of any conduct issues. So, your the ALSA has been very much a prudentially driven piece, and now the supervisors are saying, well, actually, where is conduct? Where is the treating customer fairly aspect? What does this mean for product and pricing decisions? Why is none of that coming through from the ALSA itself? And it's mainly because the focus has not been on that. And now you have a separate regulator in the UK now, the FCA, particularly asking for information around that and expecting the ORSA to drive that. So it won't take too long before you start having ASIC and others saying, well, we want to see from those reports that you're sending to APRA information around the conduct agenda. That would be one aspect. I think just to also cover off the, where does this go forward? I think if you look at what the UK experience has been, and hopefully it doesn't get repeated here in Australia, you're looking around what's the value that the risk function is providing and delivering, particularly at the group level. And too often what's happened in the UK, because of all of these pressures, it's very regulatory driven, there is a lot of data, a lot of material that goes into the group risk function, and actually they become mere data aggregators. You know, they're spending all their time trying to collect all the information for the next board risk committee, for the next board report, and actually there's not enough analysis actually going on around, you know, what better decisions can we make around credit market liquidity, for example. You know, where can we actually take more risk? You know, that's the sort of insight which really should start to be driven now out of the ORSA process and from the risk functions, which is not necessarily happening at the moment. So that's certainly an area, I think, of future development.
I think if I had one thing, though, I'd say get the target state documented and encourage boards to ask their companies to document their target state, because until you actually know what it is you're aiming for, you don't know how much resource it's going to take to actually get there, and then you can start having the discussion about what's achievable and what's not and what's important to you and what's not. But when it's all just in people's heads and not written down, it's very hard to actually have that meaningful discussion.
Okay, we might wrap that up. Please join me in thanking Rob and Brian for their presentation, and a reminder to everyone to fill out their feedback forms and join the Twitter conversation. Thanks.